Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in. Our next guest is our good friend Sheldon Richmond, Vice President of the Future of Freedom Foundation and editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom. Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Always glad to be with you.
Well, I'm always very happy to have you here, and always happy to read your articles at fff.org. You can tell they're old school if they got fff.org. Am I right? There you go. TGIF, the goal is freedom. Article for this Friday is Frederick Bastiat and Subjective Marginal Utility. And before anybody thinks that's boring because it sounds boring, just wait because you'll find out that it's really exciting. Right, Sheldon?
I believe it is.
Well, what's so exciting about it then?
Well, one thing it does is show that economics is about people. You know, when you, it seems to me that when you hear discussions of economics, either in the news or, gosh, even a normal regular textbook you're bound to find at college, it's this weird, the economy's kind of a machine that's got to be tended, you know, usually by government to make sure it's running right and, you know, put the throttle on sometimes, put the brake on sometimes, and it's disembodied. It's divorced from human beings. Well, the, Bastiat and the tradition, especially the Austrian tradition that came about 20 years later, and my point is they have a lot in common, is it shows that economics is people. The economy is people. People pursuing objectives that they regard as important to make their lives better, to improve their lot in life and their family's lot in life. And the institutions that arise out of people pursuing their objectives, that's what economics is about. It's flesh and blood. Let's call it humanistic economics.
Well, now, so when you look at it that way, why does that cause you to get things right that the scientists or pseudoscientists miss?
Well, for one thing, if you take people out of it, you almost make them an afterthought that somehow, oh yeah, they'll get the benefits of whatever, you know, the policymakers are going to do. That's how you're thinking about it. Yeah, it's not. First of all, it's not going to be good for people. And it's going to lead into this sort of planning mentality that the economy is only a machine. You know, a machine, yeah, think of a machine like in a big plant or something. It needs to be tended. It's not human. You need a human being there, smart and understands the machine to make sure it's well-oiled and has, you know, all the parts when they wear out. And, you know, so it's a dehumanized look at the economic process. But what Bastiat and then the later Austrians constantly pound away at is that we're talking about people pursuing their ends, and therefore the policy makers, the planners, are just getting in the way. They're substituting their judgment for our judgment, and that can't end up good.
All right. Well, two things. First of all, we need to talk about exactly what you mean by marginal utility and all that, but before that, if you could, I guess, give us an example of what you mean, where the pseudoscientists end up, you know, with their magnificent plan. And don't invoke the Soviet Union. Talk about American Democrats and Republicans and technocrats. How they mess things up by missing the point that you're making here about human action versus some car that's got to be tinkered with or whatever.
Yeah, okay. It's very easy. In fact, it relates to an article I had yesterday. So the two articles work together. As we know from reading the papers, we know that this week fast food workers have been walking off the job in different cities for 24 hours to protest the low wage. And so there's a movement that's sort of now building behind them that we ought to double the minimum wage or more than double it from, what is it, $7.25 to $15 an hour. so that these people can have a living wage. Well, I'm totally in sympathy with people having wages, high wages, much more than a living wage. But the minimum wage idea embodies this mentality I'm talking about. The idea that a wage can just be decreed, that it's just a number. Somehow we just, you know, throw a dart at a board, and that's how people come up with the wage. And they don't understand that the wage is the result of a process. And I want to talk about the process. I think it's not free, and I want it to be free. But as it stands now, I mean, if you tinker with a wage without doing anything else, and you sort of just decide to raise it because out of the goodness of your heart, and let's assume the motives are all good, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the objective that you are aiming at. You may end up throwing people out of work in the name of raising their wages, which I think everyone would agree is would be a bad outcome. So that's what I mean by the planning mentality. It's, you know, if you have a machine and you you make some adjustment in it, I presume the adjustment will take its effect, and if you understand the machine, it will then do what you want it to do. But an economy is not like that. You can't say, oh, I think the wage of fast food workers should be higher, therefore I pass a decree. It may not be below $15, and everybody's going to be happy. Uh-uh. It doesn't work that way.
All right, now wait a minute. Let me pretend to be a Democrat for a second, but one who's actually been to school, and say, well, now, hold on a minute. I know that, hey, at some very edge of the margin somewhere, people are going to be thrown out of work for a raise in the minimum wage. But on the other hand, you know, they may be better off than stuck in a situation that is ultimately exploitative if they're making so little. You know, waking up in the morning and working 8 to 5, and they're still making so little they can't hardly survive, that what's that worth anyway? You're better off on unemployment or taking out a loan and getting some better skills and whatever. And meanwhile, it's sort of a dehumanizing and horrible thing to have. And, you know, they're kind of collectivists, the Democrats, to have a society where we value people's lives so little, you know, that we're willing to let them basically go hungry, pay them so little to show up at work that they can't take care of themselves. They all have to go on welfare anyway, right? I mean, the minimum wage, they say, you know, that all food stamps and WIC and Medicare and all this stuff is basically just welfare for Walmart, ultimately, because they won't pay their employees enough.
Well, that's why they need to read yesterday's article as well as today's. The point of that is to show that the way to help people, lower skilled people who have low wages, is not to decree a higher wage, and then if they lose their jobs, say, oh, well, it's good. Those were crappy jobs anyway. That hardly seems very humane. What I do is say that what I point out is that wages will rise. Even, you know, look, there's a lot of reasons wages rise, but one thing that can keep wages from rising is lack of alternatives, right? If you can walk off a job and find an alternative job or go into business for yourself, you know, in a small scale, a street vendor, let's say, a taxi driver, or form a worker-owned project, enterprise, then you can basically say to an employer who you don't like, who's paying low wages or not treating you well, screw you. So you have clout as a worker to the extent you have options, alternatives. Now, the point of yesterday's article was to show that government systematically closes off options, and usually as a favor to people who are already established in business. And I give a list of some. There are many more, but occupational licensing, hundreds of professions, and I'm not talking about doctors. I'm talking about all kinds of work. In Louisiana, I'm talking about florists. You need a license, a costly license, to get into a business. And who gives the test? The existing practitioners of the work. And they're not interested in seeing a flood of new competitors. It lowers their incomes. So it's harder to get in. You have to spend thousands of dollars, let's say, to go to a school, a special class, even if it's not terribly relevant. You have to then maybe spend money for the fee to take the test, and it's costly. So there's all kinds of barriers. Zoning puts up barriers. First of all, it makes housing more expensive. It often means you can't use your house or apartment for a small business because, you know, it's not zoned commercial, and you can get in trouble for that. Intellectual property puts barriers in the way of people starting businesses because, you know, they could get sued if their product is regarded as infringing someone's patent or copyright. There's a whole bunch of things. Taxes and regulations obviously take much more a toll on an individual trying to start up a business than an established business or certainly a big corporation. They have a legal department and an accounting department. They say, here, you worry about it. But think about just a small-scale person who wants to leave his job because he hates it. He hates the, you know, the wage, the onerousness of a wage job, and wants to start a small business. He's going to be intimidated by all the rules. And so all those things, and there's a ton of them, and they're systematic, they've been added on over the years, cut off people's alternatives. And if you cut off people's alternatives, you are reducing their bargaining clout. And if you reduce their bargaining clout, they have to take whatever they can get. And employers know that. Employers know that if they have a worker that they regard as troublesome or an upstart or somebody who is asking a lot of questions and maybe is, you know, lippy and has suggestions about why don't we do it this way, he doesn't have to care about getting rid of the guy because there's a ton of other people in line who will take the job because their options have been cut off. That's what we need to talk about. This business with the minimum wage is a cruel hoax on low-income people and low-skilled people. It's like, oh, the white elite, you know, the ruling white elite will throw a few crumbs to low-income people, and they'll be so grateful to us. Meanwhile, they'll leave all these barriers to alternatives in place. That's no coincidence. It's a cruel hoax on those people.
Yeah, well, that's what Harry Brown always said, right? The government, they break your leg and then hand you some crutches.
Exactly. And then right. They go, and the crutches aren't even good crutches. They break.
Yeah, and if it wasn't for us, you wouldn't be able to get around at all.
Right, because
the
they
muggers
want people,
would get you.
They want their votes. They want people beholden and dependent. So they talk them into, oh yeah, it's not our fault that you can't find other alternatives. It's, you know, it's the system, and here we're trying to fix the system by raising the minimum wage or by you know, giving you WIC or some crap like that. But it's a joke, and the leaders who spout this stuff, they must know by now it's a joke, because after all these years, how come we still talk about people being in poverty? How come, you know, if the system, if their ideas worked, wouldn't this problem have been in the past now? What's going on? It doesn't work. They don't want it to work, which means, in effect, it is working. It's working for the sake of the power elite.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. I think probably a big part of the problem is people, you know, libertarianism is that unified field theory that puts all these different criticisms into a big pile together, where other people sometimes can't quite make the connection. Because, you know, I grew up my whole life where you didn't have to be a political person at all. Everyone knows at some level, whether it's just a lawyer joke level or not, but everybody knows that government is corrupt, that the taxi cab business in every town is a racket, that the whole thing, you know, you're polite to call it lowercase f fascism. It might just be capital F, you know, the way it's all just gangsterism. Or if you know anybody who ever was in the army, he could tell you, yeah, man, we did a secret war in El Salvador where we killed all these people and nobody ever knew about it or whatever. You know what I mean? Everybody knows that there's this alternative reality, the real reality, compared to the one on TV, where everything is a rigged game. And I can tell you about the cab business. That's a great one that you brought up, where here a regular guy who's not very good at much and maybe can't even read very well could have a car and drive for a living. And maybe you could argue in a collectivist basis that the town, the city or the county has the right to make him get a background check and make sure he's not a felon or whatever. If I might concede that one, you know, all other things being equal, but it ought to be anybody can just get in their car and have a phone number and give people rides. What the hell is this? A Soviet Union or something? But instead,
right.
Every cab business in America is run as a political cartel out of the commissioner's court or the city council. It's not even a business at all.
True.
It's a Nazi thing.
No, and right, and it's not just cabs. In some cities where they've allowed this, there's something called the jitney, which is something between a cab and a bus, right? It doesn't quite have a fixed schedule or route maybe as a fixed route, but not a fixed schedule. It's some kind of hybrid that is not, and the vehicles aren't as large as a bus, but they're bigger than cabs. And where they've been allowed to work, they're quite nice for a lot of people. And yet they're not allowed in some cities because they don't want to either fool with the, they don't want to mess up the municipal bus system, which is, you know, usually owned by the city, or interfere with the cab cartel, which is a source of patronage and all kinds of favoritism. And it hurts people. You know, we know what people can do if simply left alone. And the reason we know this, even people of low with, you know, with few resources, there's been plenty of study of the what's known as the informal market in Latin America and other places. And by this, I don't mean the black market. It's more like a gray market, right? It's not the black market in drugs or stuff that has been declared contraband. We're talking about people who are sort of selling things which aren't illegal, but they're doing it without the official papers, the permits and all that stuff. And maybe they can't even afford to rent a store, so they're using a kiosk or a push cart or something like that. It's and for one reason or another, the police and the governments just look the other way. Those people do very well for themselves. I mean, they really get a start on life. And if they work very hard, they save, and they get their, you know, they help their kids. They're thwarted from getting maybe even more successful because of all the legal stuff. But you can see we still have an indication of what people can do if the government even just does as much as look the other way and leave them alone. They buy and sell, and you know, it's mutual aid, it's division of labor, it's all the stuff that radical free market people predict will happen. It's not just a prediction, because we see it. There have been many studies of Peru and, you know, places all throughout Latin America where the informal market thrives. It's what keeps people alive.
Well, now here's the problem that we're up against too, which is the reason that our government can afford 7,000 hydrogen bombs is because there's so many people making so much money, because there is as much freedom as there actually is. And the American people have been able to afford one of the meanest governments ever, certainly the biggest government ever. I guess you can't really compare it to, well, no, I mean, really, if you count since the end of World War II, never even mind all the terror bombing during World War II, but just since the end of World War II, you're talking Nazi-level body counts of civilians at the hands of the American Empire. I mean, you could compare it to the very worst regimes, and it's because of freedom, right? All these people producing all this great stuff, is they're just ripe for the tax man. They don't care. They'll cut the golden goose's throat just for one egg, and there's so many gooses to take the eggs from. They don't care, you know?
No, that's a good point. This is a very rich country, and I would argue that it's, you know, because of the degree of entrepreneurship that's permitted, even though it's highly thwarted in a lot of ways. But that has enabled the government to, suck an awful lot of wealth from the people. And yet it still leaves, because there's so much, it leaves enough for, for people to do, you know, relatively okay. Sure, we'd be doing better if they weren't sucking all that money away, but it doesn't leave the general population destitute. So people don't notice it. Plus, they get all the propaganda about how this is all good for their security, otherwise the barbarians will be, you know, pouring through the gates and whatnot. So, yeah, you make a great point. In a way, the wealth has, in a way, has come back to haunt us, because the government can get away with so darn much.
Yeah, I learned that from Star Wars, and I was a little kid, that was what was wrong with the Republic, was it was free, and so everybody made so much money that then they got as greedy as the pile of money was high, and then it all became a corrupt evil empire, and they killed everybody. So, there you go. Jedi Knights couldn't stop it.
Well, there's a lot of ironies like that. I mean, Hayek pointed out that one of the great things about a free market is you don't have to understand how it works for it to work. Right, it's just people going about their business, and it works. That's the point. It's market forces are in that sense impersonal. We're not aiming at creating market forces. You and I are just trading, buying and selling. But that, as a result of that, you get this big overall order. This institution, the price system, and whatnot. And we don't really have to understand how it works. Obviously, it would never get off the ground if you understand it first. How did it ever start? But the danger of that is, since nobody understands, well, I won't say nobody understands how it works, since most people don't need to understand how it works, they don't know what will threaten it. They take it for granted. And so what's a virtue is also a huge, it's not a vice, but it's a danger. The fact that it doesn't require our understanding.
Right. Yeah, all technologies are double-edged swords, one way or the other, you know?
Yeah, you know, if there's a deity, he had a really bad sense of humor.
Yeah. Or a really good one, depending on how evil you are, I suppose.
I think, you know, Mencken said that, you know, he didn't think there was one god. He thought there was a committee of gods. Because that's the only thing, that's the only reason you could explain some of these problems. It was designed by a committee.
Yeah, well, he was good with the quips. Not me so much. But, all right. Well, and I want to bring up one last thing here at the very end, which this is pretty much universal. The cost of driving a car. And you can get a car pretty cheap from somebody somewhere, you know, for under a grand or whatever. You can scrape one together. But, man, all the insurance and all the licenses and all the fees and all the different trips you got to make down there and all the different crap, it is really cost prohibitive to someone who, say, has some health problems. You know what I mean? And I know this actually, again, from being a cab driver for so long. I've met 150,000 people before in my life, and I've talked to them all, and I know what they're all about and what they're going through and whatever. And this is a huge problem for people that they could drive if they were free, but they're not.
Well, and another thing, that's true. A lot
and
of
that's
people
everything
also,
for getting to
people,
your new job or trying to get a new job is you've got to have a car so you can go get a new job.
Right.
And then so you can show up at it tomorrow.
And a lot of the things the government has done, and whether this was the objective or not, you know, who knows, you'd have to look at each case. But one of the things the government, various kinds of government regulations have done is to create the necessity for a car. For people who might otherwise not need one. For example, zoning, the traditional philosophy of zoning, it might have changed in recent years, was to separate uses. So residential areas were kept separate from commercial areas, were kept separate from, say, light industry. So you had to travel to get to a job. You couldn't just walk to your job.
Right.
And since, as we said, jitneys were not allowed, and cabs were made artificially expensive by the cartel, a lot of people want a car who would never have bought one. So it's just another same old, same old.
Yep. Giant perversions of the market every time the government breathes. All right, FFF.org, that's where you find Sheldon Richmond. Thanks, Sheldon.
Anytime, Scott. Thank you.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first, and telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, Al Scott here. I think you ought to consider subscribing to The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation, in print or online. The Future of Freedom features the best writers in the libertarian movement, the fearless Jacob Hornberger, individualist anarchist Sheldon Richmond, and crusading journalist Jim Bovard, along with Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Tim Kelly, Richard Ebling, and many more. And the July issue features one by your favorite radio host on America's Middle East policy, entitled Stupidity or the Plan. So head on over to fff.org/subscribe and sign up for The Future of Freedom in print or online. That's fff.org/subscribe and tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. Hey, Al Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Oh, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.